Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Peter Beinart, professor and journalist, and perhaps the cutting-edge thinker on American Judaism and Israel, whose article, The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, created a firestorm of comment last year. We'll also have visits from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Every now and then there are some weeks when being a congregational rabbi is just, well, hard. Of course, there are the High Holy Days with their increased expectations and attendance, the plethora of services we officiate at and sermons we deliver, large numbers of participants, complex and demanding music, you know, I'm also a cantor, of course, and a myriad of complicated and very, very specific details to attend to. And then there's Passover, when there are many ritual and congregational duties, plus the personal demands that every Jew experiences, who's hosting a large Seder and preparing for the very complicated festival itself, and of course you have to eat matzah. And then there are several other times in the year when the rituals and personal obligations in congregational life can seem overwhelming. But there are those other, unexpected times when things just seem to come down all at once, without warning or preparation. Usually this time in the Jewish year is a pretty relaxed one. All the holidays, including Sukkot and Simchat Torah, that is all the fall festival orgy of services, are over. There's been time enough to begin to clean up some of the leftover people and projects that we couldn't get to over that long festival season. And it's still a ways until we have to get ready for Hanukkah. Typically, early November in the synagogue calendar and in a congregational rabbi's life is a very nice time. Usually, at least where I live, the weather even cooperates. But my last couple of weeks have proven the old Yiddish proverb that Mensch tracht und Gott lacht. We plan, but God laughs. It all started during Sukkot, actually, before the fall festivals even ended. In fact, between the Shabbat of Sukkot and the following Sunday, just after Simchat Torah, I conducted 5 funerals or memorial services. Wendy and I had a big post-Sukkot party that Sunday with the kids and lots of guests, and the next night our assistant rabbi, Jason Holtz, whom you know as an occasional Two Jewish newscaster on Two Jewish, went into the hospital for a dangerous ailment. That week was taken up with hospital visits for Rabbi Holtz and 4 other temple members with serious illnesses, plus covering all the various work that Rabbi Holtz normally does. We are all praying for a speedy and complete recovery for our young rabbi. It was a shocking turn of events for him and for my entire temple. And then, this week in my congregation, 3 more funerals or memorials, including the sudden death of an apparently healthy young woman, and 2 more younger women diagnosed with breast cancer. Wow. On a selfish level, this means I haven't had a full day off now since Labor Day, not counting a couple of days I missed when I had a little minor surgery. And that the kinds of challenges I personally am dealing with over these weeks are about as hard as it gets in the rabbinate, all while covering 2 people's more than full-time jobs. But on a higher plane, all of this can get you thinking about the general fragility of life and the simple fact that we know a whole lot less about the future and sometimes even about the present than we think we do. It's a cliche, of course, but no matter how elaborately we plan, how carefully we prepare, or how certain we are that we know what we're doing and where we're going, ultimately it really is all in God's hands. And when we remember that, we tend to act a little better, a little more caring, a little more compassionately. We tend to value each moment more. And sometimes that makes us act, well, a little more boldly. To play us in this morning from the 4th Shal Shelet Festival of New Jewish Music, here's a song called Gesher. It's a new setting of Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav's famous maxim, "The whole world is a narrow bridge. The main thing is not to be afraid.
Kol ha'olam kulo gesher tzar me'od ve'aikar lo lifachet klal. Kol ha'olam kulo gesher tzar me'od ve'aikar lo lifachet klal. Kol ha'olam kulo gesher tzar me'od. To my left and to my right, the jaws of the abyss, by its twinkling teeth I chart my course, fear singing in my ears. To my left and to my right, the jaws of the abyss, by its twinkling teeth I chart my course, fear singing in my ears. How can I be safe on a narrow bridge? How can I be strong till the day I die? How can I be safe on a narrow bridge? How can I be strong till the day I die?
Don't look down,
keep going.
Don't look down,
keep growing.
Don't look down,
keep moving. Don't look down, keep going. Don't look down, keep growing. Don't look down, keep moving.
Oh, to my left, to my right, the jaws of the abyss, by its twinkling teeth I chart my course.
That was Gesher from the Shal Shelet Festival, sung by Judith Silver. You know, I've always wondered about that Nachman of Bratslav statement. The whole world is a narrow bridge, and the main thing is lo lefached klal, not to be afraid. Maybe I understand it better now. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Peter Beinart, was already a well-thought-of young Jewish intellectual who had edited The New Republic and become a professor and kind of media star in America on American, Jewish, and Israeli questions. And then he wrote a seminal essay on the failure of the American Jewish community. Find out how the American Jewish community fails, what we can do about that, and how it affects Israel and us when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
On Sunday afternoon, November 20th, 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, the beautiful sacred service by Swiss-American composer Ernest Bloch will be performed by the Tucson Masterworks Chorale. This fantastic piece of music was originally commissioned by San Francisco's Temple Emmanuel, and it's one of the 20th century's finest classical works. Bloch described this passionate and romantic setting of text for the Jewish Saturday morning service as a cosmic poem, a glorification of the laws of the universe. For the Bloch Sacred Service, the Masterworks Chorale is conducted by Marcella Molina and will feature Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan as the baritone soloist. Don't miss this extraordinary performance, Sunday, November 20th at 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson. For tickets or more information, call the Tucson Masterworks Chorale at 730-5640 or Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
The other day, I was at a business networking breakfast, and I introduced myself to the fella sitting next to me by saying, "Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza." Without missing a beat, he said, "I know, you're the, now repeat after me guy." Well, it was clear he'd heard my commercials before, but the guy sitting next to us was a little puzzled. Obviously, he had no idea who I was. So I tried a little experiment. I asked the first guy to tell the second guy what he knew about Mama's just from hearing our commercials. "Easy," he said. "Mama's is a family-run restaurant that's been around Tucson a long time. One of the things they have is a huge pizza called the family size. Oh, and they pride themselves on having great atmosphere and value." So there, in about 10 seconds, this guy who had never heard of Mama's before basically knew the whole story. And now, so do you. Except that we have four convenient locations in Tucson. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through 8th grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school, and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register, arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888, or visit THAAZ.org. We're delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Peter Bainert. He's a Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, Associate Professor of Journalism and Political Science at City University of New York, Senior Political Writer for the Daily Beast, a contributor to Time. You can see him on TV and radio, and I don't know how he has any time for his young family. He's one of the most interesting and in some ways controversial young Jewish intellectuals in America. He has a new book coming out next spring. His first book, The Good Fight, Why Liberals and Only Liberals Can Win the War on Terror and Make America Great Again, was published in 2006. His second book, The Icarus Syndrome, was published by HarperCollins in June 2010. It was a history of American hubris. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the article that you wrote last year, The Failure of the American Jewish Establishment, provoked tremendous comment. And it still does. You essentially say that the whole way that American Jews approach, or the American Jewish establishment approaches, how to inculcate love of Israel and Zionism is kind of off base, no?
Yes. I think that the fundamental problem is that the organized American Jewish community has defined being pro-Israel as being in support of the Israeli government of the day, its policies, or at least its right to pursue whatever policies it wants. And I think that's as bad a definition of being pro-Israel as it would be a definition of being pro-American to say that you're being pro-American by supporting the policies of the current American government. I think a better definition of pro-Israel would be that you believe in the principles of Israel's Declaration of Independence. Israel doesn't have a constitution, but it has a Declaration of Independence, and it talks about a state that will pursue full equality of social and political rights, irrespective of race, religion, and sex. I think that vision is in very sharp contrast to the policies that are being pursued, particularly by this Israeli government, and that's why I think that the definition of what it means to be pro-Israel in the United States, I think, needs to be opened up and I think altered.
Well, I might agree with you. Playing devil's advocate, the answer that people would give is, well, you can't really judge Israel unless you're living there, unless you're experiencing what Israelis experience. How can we tell them how they should run their government?
Yeah, I would just note that that is not a position that American Jews take about any other place in the world. So, for instance, American Jews are very organized American Jewish groups, very, very willing to criticize Palestinian leaders all the time. But we don't live amongst the Palestinians either. So if we don't have the right to criticize Israeli policy because we don't live there, then what right do we have to criticize Hamas? What right do we have to criticize Ahmadinejad? We don't live in Iran. We didn't live in the Soviet Union when they were repressing Jews. We don't live in Darfur. So it seems to me if you tried to apply that principle with any degree of consistency, it would completely neuter your ability to have moral opinions about things that happen outside of your borders.
We will talk much more with Peter Bainert about American Jews and Israel and many other things when we come back in just a few moments on Two Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmaker's Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two-bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
Please plan to join me on Sunday, November 6th, for a fantastic evening honoring Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, starting at 5:30 p.m. It will be a memorable night indeed. The Tucson Hebrew Academy is holding its 7th annual Tikkun Olam event. That's Sunday, November 6th at 5:30 p.m. at the Jewish Community Center. Tikkun Olam means repair the world, and it's an important call to action for Jews everywhere in the world. Who better personifies this than Gabby Giffords? This wonderful evening will bring the entire community together to honor Congresswoman Giffords. She'll be joined by her friend and colleague, Congresswoman Shelley Berkeley from Nevada, with a very special MC, Dr. Richard Carmona, the 17th Surgeon General of the United States. Proceeds from the event go to benefit the Tucson Hebrew Academy's scholarship and affordability programs. It'll feature music, a silent and live auction, and great food. Tickets are on sale, and some sponsorship opportunities still remain. Call 520-529-3888 today for more information, or visit the website at thaaz.org. Let's join together in the spirit of Tikkun Olam, honoring Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords on Sunday, November 6th, and supporting Jewish education and scholarship. Call THA at 529-3888 or go to the website thaaz.org. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com. That's TOOJewishRadio@Yahoo, or visit our website at TooJewishRadio. You can hear past and present shows through the website, TooJewishRadio.com, or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Our Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel is set for June of 2012. If you are interested in going with me, email me, also at TooJewishRadio@Yahoo.com, or call 520-327-4501. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart. Boker Tov. Good morning, Guy.
Boker Tov.
There's an interesting program coming up this week, which speaks to a larger topic. Is there some kind of a change in the relationship between America and Israel? And I know they're talking about is there a pragmatic shift? Judaic Studies has a program on November 9th with a lot of prominent people, Peter Beinart and others. Tell us a little bit about, do you think there's a major change in Israel-U.S. relations now?
You know, that's a very interesting question, and it's very hard to answer. I think the bigger change that we see is with the relationship between the Jewish community in the States and Israel. I'm not so sure if there is, if we still see on the ground a change in the government relationship. I think regarding governments, we see kind of contradicting lines. On one hand, we see some declarations that are kind of less friendly or stuff, but on the other hand, when you look at the ground on really connecting and doing things together, for instance, the IDF and the American Army have never been so closed ever. Even here in Tucson, the Raytheon is involved in developing some of the systems that are very critical to protect Israel.
And also in intelligence communities seem to be working more closely, more hand in glove than they ever have before too.
Yes,
at least that's what they secretly tell us.
It seems so, at least publicly. But I think the interesting question is about the Jewish community. I think the Jewish community here in the States has a lot of challenge in facing Israel. Because on one hand, people here want to embrace Israel. Israel is the Jewish homeland. It's half of the Jewish people in the world. On the other hand, Israel presents an alternative. An alternative to Jewish identity, an alternative to the way of life here in the States. And I think it's very challenging also for the American community, because probably it's the first time in Jewish history where there is a diaspora of choice, where people stay in the diaspora out of free will and not out of exile. And I feel this makes the relationship very complex. On one hand, you want to love, you want to hug, you want to be together. On the other hand, this other community, this Israel community, brings an interesting mirror that makes you probably less comfortable. You need to face your own identity and you need to kind of justify what you do.
You know, and it's also, of course, true that Americans are susceptible to public opinion around the world. And American Jews are, to be honest, probably a little more international than most Americans. So while most Americans seem to be supporting Israel very strongly, younger American Jews and American Jews in general can read the New York Times and they know what's going on in Europe and the sort of generally negative press that Israel gets. And I think it has an effect too.
It definitely has an effect. But I must admit that from my perspective, it seems that many of them feel more comfortable to focus their engagement with Israel on the Israeli-Arab conflict because that conflict is far away from them. It doesn't force them to handle the real questions of what does it mean to be Jewish and what is my relationship with the Jewish homeland of Israel. It's easier for them because the Arab-Israel conflict is something far away. You can criticize Israel. You can criticize the Arabs. You don't need to handle real deep questions within yourself.
About your own identity.
Yeah.
This program is going to be at Judaic Studies. It's on November 9th. And what's the best place for people to go to find out more about what should be a terrific program?
Yeah, the program will be on November 9th between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. at the Student Union Memorial Center at the South Bell Room. You can go to Judaic Studies website to get more information. You can also call the Israel Center. We'll give you the information and the links. And you can go, the Judaic Studies website is on judaic.arizona.edu. And that's where you can see most of the information.
All right, Guy, thanks very much. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant, J-Bar, and Downtown Kitchen and Cocktails. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
J-Bar is a great place to go for the holidays. What's special about it?
I think the things that's special about it, it's so casual. The food speaks of where we live. Great views of the city. Phenomenal margaritas. Inexpensive, casual, spontaneous. Friends in from out of town. You don't feel like cooking. Kids are in. Come on over to J-Bar.
My wife's favorite are the fish tacos, which are not like the fish tacos get everywhere else. They're just spectacular.
No, we like to do things a little bit differently, and I think a little bit better, and just really celebrate the flavors of where we live.
A great fun place for a holiday meal or any time. What's the best way to get a hold of J-Bar?
Give us a call, 615-6100. Go online, visit our website, www.janos.com.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Want to know what's really going on in the relationship between Israel and America? Find out Wednesday, November 9th from 1 to 9 p.m. at the University of Arizona's Student Union Memorial Center, the South Ballroom, as the Arizona Center for Judaic Studies invites the community to its symposium on the U.S.-Israel relationship on the verge of a paradigmatic shift. Internationally renowned scholars and diplomats will discuss these critically important issues. The symposium speakers include Peter Beinart, Itamar Rabinovich, Steve Spiegel, Alon Pincus, David Makovsky, and Gil Ryback. They'll all discuss the key question of whether the U.S. is on the verge of a dramatic change in its relationship with Israel, or whether it's simply going through a phase like it has gone through before. The symposium is for everyone, students and scholars, policymakers, and the general public. It's open to all. To register, contact the Arizona Center for Judaic Studies. Call 520-626-5758. That's 626-5758. Or contact Judaic Studies on the web through their website, Judaic, J-U-D-A-I-C dot Arizona dot E-D-U. Call 626-5758 for tickets. General admission is $18 a person. Sponsorships are available. Admission is free with a valid U of A CAT card or $18 without. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been playing with the fascinating subject of the Cairo Geniza, the huge treasure trove of medieval and somewhat later Jewish documents. You know, one of the things that I had the privilege of working on a million years ago when I was an undergraduate was Jewish trade in the Middle Ages and the Raidenites who supposedly carried on trade from Spain all the way to China, and nobody really believed it except that the document that kind of led people to think they existed was in an Arab geographer's book, and why would he write about Jewish traders if there wasn't some justification? Well, it turns out that some of the stuff from the Geniza, the Cairo Geniza, reflects a great deal of trade and Jewish merchant sort of colonies all along the spice route, all along the Silk Route, that nobody knew existed until they found this stuff.
Right. A lot of the documents in the Geniza are purely secular and purely commercial in nature, but they give insight into culture, the nature of the banking system, letters of credit, how families spread out over these trading routes because cousins trusted cousins and in-laws trusted in-laws, which is not necessarily the case today.
But, not always a good idea even today.
But the other interesting thing is, so we just finished the season of the High Holidays, and more on the High Holidays than on most other days of the year, we read piyutim, we read these poems written by people we rightly or wrongly think of as Spanish Jews from the so-called Golden Age in Spain, which is the late 8th, 9th, and 10th century. But many of these Spanish Jews then moved to Egypt or other places in North Africa. And they either wrote originally or learned to write in Arabic or Judeo-Arabic. So, you know, among the polarities that we learn to question when we study the rich, unbelievably large collection that is the Geniza, and we've only really uncovered the tip of the iceberg so far, is the polarity that we usually posit between Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews. Because where exactly do the Arabic-speaking Jews in the Middle East fit into that? They don't. I mean, the Sephardic Jews spoke a form of Spanish and wrote in Latin, in Hebrew letters, but they wrote a Latin-based language. And we all know about Yiddish-speaking Jews. But these Jews in the Middle East, who basically spoke and wrote in a form of Arabic and thought very much in Arabic terms, represent a world about which we know far too little. It's a very rich and beautiful world. And the more we discover about it, the more we say, aha.
It's fascinating. You know, it's almost like discovering a whole Jewish world that nobody teaches you about today, and that still exists in a way because those communities, mostly they're now in Israel, have all kinds of customs and traditions that Ashkenazi Jews who think we know everything about Judaism never even encountered, and many of those are much older than the Ashkenazi traditions.
Exactly.
Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish is a Public Service. Rabbi Bloom and Father Michael get into a car accident and it's bad. Both cars are crushed, totaled, but amazingly, neither one of the clerics is hurt at all. After they crawl out of their cars, Rabbi Bloom sees the priest's collar and says, "Just look at our cars. Nothing left, but we're unhurt. You're a priest. I'm a rabbi. It must be a sign from God. He must have meant that we should meet and be friends and live together in peace the rest of our days." And Father Michael replies, I agree with you completely. This truly must be a sign from God. Rabbi Bloom then says, look, another miracle. My car's wrecked, but the bottle of Manischewitz didn't break. God must want us to drink this and celebrate our good fortune. He opens it and hands the bottle to the priest. Father Michael takes a few big swigs, even a gulp, and passes the bottle back to Rabbi Bloom, who puts the top back on and hands it back to the priest. Father Michael asks quizzically, aren't you having any wine? No, I think I'll just wait for the police, says Rabbi Bloom. That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and drive carefully. What do you think is the essential Jewish characteristic? Is it the ability to survive, as we've been doing for 3,800 years since the days of Abraham and Sarah? Is it the enjoyment of food, without which no event seems truly Jewish? Is it our profound and ancient commitment to learning that's our most unique quality? Or is it the willingness to argue that makes us truly Jewish? You know the stereotype, two Jews, three opinions. We have developed over the millennia a remarkable talent for disagreement. It's reflected in everything from our taste in synagogues and Jewish food to our Talmudic literature. After all, what is the Talmud but a very long, extended argument? You know the classic Jewish joke about the desert island? A ship sails in a lonely part of the South Pacific. The captain sees smoke coming from what should be a deserted island. He steers for the island. As he approaches it, he's startled to find there's actually a full pier and a well-dressed man walking on a beautifully built dock. The captain crosses the gangplank and is welcomed by a guy who says his name is Goldberg. I'm astonished, Mr. Goldberg, the captain says. How'd you get here? How did you construct this magnificent dock? Oh, says Goldberg, I was shipwrecked alone 5 years ago, but the dock is nothing. Come, see the rest. So Goldberg leads the captain on a tour of his island, including a beautifully paved main street. He made the cement himself from seashells and coconut milk, a store, a school, every possible convenience. The captain oohs and ahs, but what really impresses him are the two magnificent buildings at the end of the street, both with stained glass windows. My God, Goldberg, says the captain, look at what you've done here with nothing but your bare hands. But I'm curious, what are those two amazing buildings? Oh, says Goldberg, those are the synagogues. Incredible, the captain says, phenomenal, but why do you need two of them? The one on the right is my shul, says Goldberg. The one on the left, I wouldn't be caught dead in. You may not realize that this tendency to argue is quite ancient, dating back to the very first Jew, Abraham, who in this week's Torah portion of Vayera teaches us something central through the medium of argument. In our portion last week, Lech Lecha, Abraham was called by God to leave his homeland and journey to an unknown land. Atypically for all the Jews who have followed him, he did so unquestioningly, taking a great leap of faith to a new and strange place, trusting God to bring him to his destiny without questioning. But that's not the whole story. And in this week's portion of Vayera, things are different. It includes the remarkable tale of the impending destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, a traumatic decision by God to eradicate evil, at least to try one more time. In one of the great short scenes in biblical history, God tells Abraham of his plan to destroy the wicked cities, kind of the Las Vegas and Atlantic City of their day. Instead of nodding politely and accepting God's decision, Abraham nobly steps forward and protests. And he does so with another one of those great Jewish qualities, chutzpah. What if there are 50 righteous people in Sodom? God, would you destroy the city then? Abraham asks. Wouldn't that be immoral, the judge of all the world acting unjustly? Ashofet kol haaretz lo yaseh mishpat, says Abraham. So God agrees with Abraham's objection, but the noble Abraham keeps arguing. What if there are 45 righteous? 40? How about 30? Perhaps God wouldn't destroy Sodom for the sake of 20 righteous people. How about 10? A bare minion. And amazingly, God agrees that even 10 would be enough to save the cities. Of course, there aren't 10 righteous people in Sodom. I mean, you don't go to Sodom for a minion. And the flesh pots of evil are still marked for destruction. But it's Abraham's noble defense of what might just turn out to be a righteous remnant that stands out. This is the essential way all Jews ever since have interacted with God. We question, we struggle, we test God. always seeking greater justice in the world. We argue with God, become holier and better people because of that process. In Pirkei Avot, the great ethical tractate of the Mishnah, we are told that kol machloket l'shem shamayim, every argument for the sake of heaven, will yield lasting benefit. If we argue as Abraham did for the sake of justice, holding even God to a higher standard, then we are being the best Jews we possibly can be, and thus the best human beings we can be. And when we argue against immorality in the world, anywhere in the world, in Syria, anywhere, or against the environmental destruction of the planet, or in favor of the rights of immigrants, or the unemployed, or the homeless, we continue what Abraham began in this week's portion. Machlokot l'shem shamayim, arguments truly for the sake of heaven. If we can make these kinds of sacred arguments, our lives will, like Abraham's, bring blessing. And then, as the Torah tells us, we too will become a blessing to all the families of the earth. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Peter Bainert, will explain just how the American Jewish establishment is failing. Find out when we return on Two Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114. We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli aircraft struck back at Palestinian terrorists in Gaza last weekend, who responded with a volley of rockets that rained down on southern Israeli towns. Palestinian officials said 9 terrorists were killed. On the Israeli side, 1 civilian was murdered, 4 wounded. Exchanges of fire are common between southern Israel and the Gaza Strip, controlled, of course, by the Hamas terrorists, but this is the worst we've seen in months. Gaza Ministry spokesman Adham Abu Salmiya said the 9 were killed and 15 wounded in separate attacks aimed by Israelis at terrorist targets. The Israeli civilian killed was a 50-year-old man in an apartment building in Ashkelon. An Israeli military spokesman confirmed that there were a total of 4 strikes in Gaza, saying the IDF hit Palestinian terrorists from Islamic Jihad, one of several groups that fires rockets into southern Israel. The first attack specifically targeted a cell responsible for a rocket attack last week that exploded deep inside Israel. The Israeli military said they will not tolerate any attempt to harm Israeli civilians. The IDF released video footage taken from a military drone showing Palestinians unloading rockets from a truck and preparing them to fire at Israel. The strike took place shortly thereafter. In other news, dozens of people involved in rioting at the Israeli embassy in Cairo were given suspended jail sentences in Egypt. An Egyptian military court handed down the 6-month suspended sentences to 73 of the protesters for using violence against military officers, that is, Egyptian ones. More than 1,000 Egyptians demonstrated at the embassy back on September 9th, many after an Egyptian Facebook group called on protesters to gather at the embassy and pee on the wall. During the demonstration, protesters tore down the Israeli flag from the high-rise building's roof for the second time in a month. The protesters broke open the 8-foot-high security wall surrounding the Israeli embassy compound, entered the building, required the immediate and emergency evacuation of Israel's ambassador to Egypt, all embassy personnel, families, and Israelis staying at the embassy by emergency air transport to Israel. 6 security employees stranded in the building were later saved by an Egyptian commando unit during a rescue operation. 3 Egyptians were killed, more than 1,000 injured in those riots. And now the rioters are free, of course. Welcome to Cairo. And a member of Saudi Arabia's royal family has offered a $900,000 reward for the capture and kidnapping of an Israeli soldier. The offer made last week by Prince Khalid bin Talal on a national Saudi television channel comes days after prominent Saudi cleric Sheikh Awad al-Qarani floated a $100,000 offer for capturing an Israeli soldier. The prince said the captured Israeli would be traded for Arab prisoners held in Israeli jails. This offer comes after Israel agreed to release more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for the freedom of captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, kidnapped and held for 5 years. Well, that's just lovely. The Saudis are now sponsoring kidnapping by terrorists in public. That's our good old American allies, the Saudi Arabians, the Arab moderates. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Peter Bainert. He is the Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, Associate Professor of Journalism and Political Science at the City University of New York. You have probably read his stuff in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Boston Globe or the Financial Times or Reader's Digest, or seen him on television on Meet the Press or Charlie Rose, the McLaughlin Group, the Colbert Report. It's fascinating. You know, you've been on all of these kind of mainstream media outlets, but you've also been on some really great fake news shows.
I was on the Colbert Report. I've actually found it one of the most difficult interviews I've ever done. It's just very weird to be being interviewed by someone who believes the opposite of what they say. And it kind of forces you to kind of, It makes it sometimes tricky to figure out what you're supposed to be doing, I found it kind of a little bit of a head spinning experience, to be honest.
I'll bet, sort of Purim and Yom Kippur all rolled into one.
it was not as fun as Purim, and in some ways, yes, almost as painful as Yom Kippur. Although I don't think I atoned for much.
Let's talk a little bit about the generation gap in America and the American Jewish community in terms of its attitude towards Israel. Older American Jews tend to be more on the my country or my second country, Israel, defend it at all costs. I got to say that right, don't I? Avoid the dual loyalty charge. Younger American Jews, somewhere in between, often not particularly closely connected to Israel. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think part of it is just simply that you've had a process of assimilation by which younger American Jews are simply less likely to identify with the notion of being members of the Jewish people. Certainly, some still do, but the percentage that do is lower. You know, you have a much higher intermarriage rate than you did several generations ago. Several decades ago. But I also think that what's important to understand is that the American Jewish community was not always overwhelmingly Zionist. American Jews really became overwhelmingly Zionist really in the 30s and 40s when they saw that the Jews of Europe needed someplace to go as a refuge, and they saw that America was not willing to open its door. So I think the bedrock justification by American Jews for Zionism, for Israel's existence as a Jewish state, has been refuge. The reason I say that is that young American Jews I don't think have ever had the experience of seeing any population of Jews around the world need Israel as a refuge. Even myself, so I'm 40. I came of age with the Soviet Jewry movement, with the Ethiopian exodus to Israel, so that played into the narrative of Israel as refuge. But if you're young today, you as an American Jew don't really need Israel as a refuge. You don't see any large group of Jews around the world who's really under anti-Semitic tyranny. And so I think it leads to a more of a willingness to fundamentally question the idea of why you need a Jewish state. So I think that questions that are completely taboo to older American Jews, which were not interestingly taboo in the first half of the 20th century, but essentially became taboo with the rise of Nazism, I think are to some degree being reopened by some young American Jews, particularly those who feel very alienated by the course of the policies pursued by the Israeli government.
So the current Israeli government under Netanyahu, who is quite likely the most articulate speaker of English ever to be prime minister of Israel.
Yeah.
It's really extraordinary. He's very articulate.
Golda Meir wasn't that, you know, she was a native English speaker too.
Yes, she was.
But not as articulate, I agree. Not as good a speaker.
No, no, she wasn't. I mean, she said fabulous things and she was your grandmother, but it wasn't...
Well, it wasn't quite the same.
Nonetheless, the policies that Netanyahu pursues sometimes seem designed purely for domestic consumption, and he doesn't, starting new building projects as soon as he possibly can when there's a provocation by the Palestinians or when there's an affront by the Americans. How does that play in the American Jewish community generationally?
Well, I think Netanyahu sees... I think Netanyahu is very concerned about Israeli support in the U.S., but I think he sees it through a very particular lens. I mean, I think that Netanyahu's contacts in the American Jewish community tend to be heavily Republican. And he also has had a long and very deep connection to the American evangelical community. And I think he tends to... I couldn't prove this, but my suspicion is that he tends to see those people as the real America, which is fundamentally in support of Israel, and to believe that a kind of the Jewish liberals who might criticize him in the New York Times now and then are kind of are not ultimately that significant. But I think that view is somewhat mistaken. There is a very strong reservoir of support for Israel virtually no matter what Israel does, or at least actually to say as long as Israel doesn't give back the territories, the West Bank and Gaza, I think that conservative evangelical Christians will be very supportive, and Orthodox Jews will. And it's important to remember that the face of American Jewry is really being transformed by the rapid demographic rise of Orthodox Jews in the young population. So younger American Jews are much more heavily Orthodox than our older American Jews. And I think Netanyahu sees that as well. But I think what he may not fully appreciate is the degree to which, in the Democratic Party and in the kind of liberal precincts, the policies that he's pursuing are provoking an alienation that I think could over time filter its way into the way that the Democratic Party responds vis-a-vis Israel. Right now, the Democrats in Congress and the Republicans in Congress are virtually indistinguishable. But I think if Israeli policy continues the way it is, I think you're going to see more grassroots, liberal, and Democratic Party strong opposition to Israeli policy.
Well, you can certainly make a case for the support of Israel being stronger now than it has been almost at any time in American in the history of Israel. But it is definitely a sectored kind of support. You mentioned the rise of Orthodox demographic in American Judaism, and that's sort of twofold. One is the tremendous birth rate in the Orthodox population, the low birth rate in liberal Jewish population, and the assimilation, intermarriage, often leading not to continued affiliation, but assimilation. So what do you see in 20 years?
Well, of course, you know, predictions, it's important to remember that there was a time when people predicted that Orthodox Jewry was going away, right?
So, my lifetime.
Yeah, so this history of predictions doesn't tend to be terribly good, and there are very smart people like Jonathan Sarnat Brandeis who argues that actually that Orthodox Jews should not be triumphalists, that there are significant issues that Orthodox Jews have not figured out how to wrestle with. And I think probably first and foremost of those, and here I'm talking about modern Orthodox Jews, who I think are roughly three-quarters of the American Orthodox population, putting aside Haredi or ultra-Orthodox Jews, the question of the role of women. I do think that one could make an argument that as in the American Jewish Orthodox community, you have seen the rise of a population of highly educated Orthodox women, it may not be sustainable to the role of women in Orthodoxy in the United States, in modern Orthodoxy, may not be sustainable, given that you now have women who are not only as well-educated secularly as are men, but increasingly are as well-educated Judaically, so have the tools to themselves challenge interpretations of Jewish law that they may be able to make pretty strong arguments, actually, whose foundations may be actually relatively weak and may come more from, you know, from minhag or tradition than actually. And I think, you know, you see that, I think, is one, will be one of the big, and I think, so I think one could imagine a situation where essentially modern Orthodoxy fractured over the role of women. But there's no question that American Orthodoxy has answered some very core needs that I think young people of all religions in the United States have, but Jews included. One is a need for strong community, which Orthodox synagogues provide a very strong sense of community. And the other, I think, is a sense for a kind of a buffer against the highly materialistic, individualistic, often degraded culture of secular America. And so I have enormous, I mean, there's a reason my own family has gone to Orthodox synagogues for many, many years, because I have enormous affection and reverence for that, and also for the project of trying to raise your kids as truly educated people, both Judaically and in secular terms. So I think I want modern Orthodoxy to succeed and flourish, but I would love to imagine a time in which proud modern Orthodox Jews could also be open to more egalitarian forms of female participation.
You know, in the interest of full disclosure, I've read The New Republic forever and really enjoyed reading you consistently there. It was a good place for you for a long time. What's the next big project for you?
Well, you know, I do have this book, The Crisis of Zionism, which is coming out in the spring, and I imagine that, or I hope that that conversation will be one that I'll continue for a while. I'm somewhat torn, to be honest. I mean, there's a part of me that really, you know, with the presidential campaign coming up, and wants to refocus on writing about American politics and foreign policy more broadly. My first two books are about American foreign policy, and there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. But there's another part of me that wants to stick with this issue because I have small kids, and I really believe that by the time my, you know, son and daughter are bar and bat mitzvah, a window will very likely have closed. I just don't think that you can have growth of the settler population at the rate that we have seen for another 10 or 20 years and still have any possibility of a Palestinian state, a viable, contiguous Palestinian state in the West Bank. So there's a part of me that feels that this is the debate to be engaged in right now while there's still time, because once that window closes, you know, who knows where we'll be.
I want to thank Peter Bannert for a great visit here on Too Jewish. You can find out more about him pretty much anywhere on the web. Is there any particular website?
You can. Most of my writing is at the Daily Beast.
At the Daily Beast. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
On Sunday afternoon, November 20th, 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel, the beautiful sacred service by Swiss-American composer Ernest Bloch will be performed by the Tucson Masterworks Chorale. This fantastic piece of music was originally commissioned by San Francisco's Temple Emmanuel, and it's one of the 20th century's finest classical works. Bloch described this passionate and romantic setting of text for the Jewish Saturday morning service as a cosmic poem, a glorification of the laws of the universe.
For the block sacred service, the Masterworks Chorale is conducted by Marcella Molina and will feature Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan as the baritone soloist. Don't miss this extraordinary performance Sunday, November 20th at 3 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel in Tucson. For tickets or more information, call the Tucson Masterworks Chorale at 730-5640 or Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. when our very special guest will be Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, one of the great intellects of the last 5 or 6 centuries, the translator of the Talmud, in honor of the Global Day of Jewish Learning next Sunday. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, where you can stream us and friend us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from Shal Shelet, the song of welcome for the Sabbath bride, Lecha Dodi, as sung at that festival by cantor Lance Rhodes and the Shir Chadash community chorus. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Lecha Dodi. Oh.